Morning. Hi, I'm Sarah Ladislaw. I'm a Senior Vice President and Director of the Energy and National Security Program here at CSIS. One of the most that we've been doing on climate change in the national and corporate interest, where we've had a series of government and private sector leaders come in and talk about the ways in which they see taking action on climate change as being part and parcel of their core interests and how they approach their strategic vision going forward. And Total has been making a number of remarkable moves recently that really go to the heart of what we're trying to get at in this series, which is how do companies not only address the need to move to a low carbon transition, but also do so in a way that helps them face all of the competitive pressures that you're seeing across the board on the horizon. So I think most of the folks in the room are familiar. Total is one of the largest oil and gas companies in the world, fourth largest, present in over 130 countries, and has formidable oil, gas, and renewable assets. But maybe to get started, Patrick, would you talk a little bit about who Total is, what drives you as a company, for those of you who might not be terribly familiar?
Total is an old company, 1924. We are born after the First World War because France realized during the First World War that a lack of access to hydrocarbons was a reason of the defeat. And we took over the shares of the Deutsche Bank in the Iraq Petroleum Company. Why do I remind that? Because it's back to one of the important DNA of Total, which is we are born in the Middle East, in fact, in Iraq, in Mesopotamia. The second part of Total, by the way, ELF, is born after the Second World War, based on the development of Africa, and the only gas field which ever existed in France, which was a gas field in southwest of France, which is over yet now, which is the second characteristic of the company. It's the only major oil and gas company with no domestic resource. So this company and this group has grown outside of our country, Middle East, Africa, and the last area of focus for the company was North Sea in the 70s with the discovery, the North Sea venture where Total has been one of the leaders. The second characteristic is that Total is an oil integrated company. We are doing everything with oil molecule, you know. We explore, we produce, we transform, we refine, we make petrochemicals, plastics, we distribute, which is important, we go end to the customers. The third characteristic, which is, of course, each time I'm going everywhere in the world, people think we are an oil company. In fact, we are also producing quite a lot of gas. It's around 55-45 today between oil and gas. And on gas, we are more a gas producer than an integrated company. And one of the strategic axes I will develop this morning is to develop the integration downstream, the gas value chain as well. And so that's a company which has also the right size in this business, mm-hmm. where because we face the volatility of the commodities and overall price, we experienced that in the last 3 years. Mm-hmm. And one of the lessons is size matters, to have a strong balance sheet in order to be able to weather the storm of this type of up and downs. And we have the right size, and we continue to grow. And that's so. These are the main characteristics, I think, of the company. We are French, so we are a little strange.
So you say Total is an oil and gas company first and foremost, born in the Middle East. You also have taken a position on the Paris Climate Accord, that you're in support of it, and have actually been doing a lot more business that's been making headlines in terms of electric power acquisitions. I think most people in the U.S. are familiar with your position with SunPower, the solar PV manufacturer, but maybe not quite as familiar with what you've done on the electricity retail side of the business with Direct Energy in France and Belgium. So, oil and gas company, but making a lot of electric power-oriented purchases. What's your vision for the company? What's the purpose of all of that?
So I will be maybe a little long to explain fundamentally. I will take that question, the strategy. In fact, you have, for us, the climate change, in fact, it's a question of evolution of our markets at the end of the day. You know, we have today a world. And this is the only, I don't have a speech, I only have one slide, which you should all know, which is of the world, the primary energy demand in 2017, and what are the projections in 2040. And in fact, you have various scenarios on this slide. So what we say, what we call the 2-degree scenario, or less than 2 degrees. So 3 degrees, 3.3 degrees, and the 4.5 degrees. And what we can observe through this slide is how the markets will evolve. And it's important for an energy company or a gas company to look to the evolution of our markets, you know. And so, of course, the Paris Agreement is fundamental, first because it has been signed by 195 countries, because, in fact, it's a reality that there is a climate change. I know that in that country, in this country, maybe my sentence is not obvious, but this is a reality. Oil and gas companies are clearly part of the problem, I would say. I don't want to be part of the problem. I want to be part of the solution. You know, I consider that a company like Total, with the size, with the financing capacities or engineering capacities, we must take the problem. And it's a field of opportunities, in fact. In particular, if you think to that as trying to have a roadmap which will be in line with the evolution of our market. What is written on this? And it is it's public, and it's not secret to Total, it's just the International Energy Agency scenario. I mean, we have our own scenarios, maybe we'll publish them, but it's just public. What is written there? It's written first that in 2040, if we want to be in a 2-degree world, we should not consume more than today, globally speaking, of energy demand. Which is an incredible challenge, because today we are 7 billion people. 1.5 billion people do not have access to energy. In 2040, we should be 9 billion. So if you think that one objective of the world is that everybody should have access to energy, which is quite a challenge, I think the more or less the same global demand is a huge energy efficiency challenge. So it's part of what any energy company must have in mind, and we are energy consumers, we are energy providers, so first thinking to energy efficiency businesses, and the way we manage our operation is a duty for us. The second observation is that, of course, it depends on the scenario, and I'm not sure that the 2-degree scenario will be in place, because in that scenario, the oil demand in 2040 should be around 80 million barrels of oil per day. And frankly, when you use all the technologies we have, even all plenty of EVs and plenty of... we don't see a world of 80 million barrels of oil per day. But there could be a lot of innovations between today and 2040, but we need more. But in that scenario, that means that the demand for oil could be lower in 20 years than today. So, of course, for an oil company, it's just a challenge. You know, if we are working in a decreasing market, we need to find other source to grow, because my objective is that Total will continue to grow in the future. So oil, we have to face that reality, and the consequence for us on oil is that we want to focus on what I call the low-cost oil. It makes no sense for me to explore oil in Arctic just to have NGOs against us to drill a well of $400 million. I have plenty of way to allocate better my capital by doing things. It does not make sense from an economic point of view. And probably Sher Yamani said that 20 years ago. Sher Yamani was the Saudi minister. He said the age of oil will not end because of lack of oil, like the age of stone did not end because of lack of stone. Yeah. And it's true. I think the idea that we will produce all the oil of the earth is just something wrong, because we have a permanent innovations, technologies, and we evolve. You have to think to that. So on oil, let's focus. Then the second lesson of it is that there is room to have more gas. Gas should be the hydrocarbon of choice for the energy transition, because it's more flexible, because there is less emission of CO2 when you make power. In fact, the real fight in terms of market share is gas against coal. I know it's also difficult. It's not difficult, by the way, in this country, because it's U.S. In fact, it's the place where this fight has already been ruined by gas. In fact, it's true. I don't know why the U.S. are perfectly in line with the 2-degree scenario. It's maybe the only country in the world which is in line, in fact, with Russia. No, it's provocation, but which is true, by the way, as well. And so for us, that means that let's invest more in gas. And in the full gas value chain. And not only in producing gas, but we need to invest in order to create the demand for gas. And so we have seen some. And when you think gas, people don't need gas. They need power, mm-hmm. electricity, or heating. And so this is why you see Total moving downstream the value chain from producing liquefaction and consuming, transforming gas to power, because this is for us the basic economic, we want to be in all the steps of the gas value chain and electricity. And so including distributing gas and power to end customers, because it's part of the business. And this is a lesson, you know, of the last 3 years. We managed to weather the storm of volatility thanks to the downstream businesses in particular. And so you have this integration is fundamental to the economic model and also to the mission. Our mission is to bring energy to the people at the end. And then what in this slide I have is that you have a growing business of renewables. There again, it's electricity. Renewables, solar or wind, or it's for providing electricity, because one of the characteristics of our world is that the demand for electricity is growing much quicker than the global energy demand. Mm-hmm. Digital world, batteries, all that. Our world will use more and more and more electricity. And in 2040, today you have only 25% of final demand is electricity. Tomorrow it will be much more than that. Sure, yeah. So this is what you need to keep in mind. And so when you build the strategy of our company, yes, we are oil and gas, but we think that we must also prepare that future, because we want to be in 20 years, or I will not be there, but I want the company to be still one of the major energy company. And so it's step by step. Of course, it's diversification. There are some challenges. We can come back on it. But this is why you see us moving. And all that I described, of course, is our contribution to the climate change challenge. Yeah. Because each time that I'm taking, this year I will take $2 billion, or more than that, $3 billion in fact, out of the cash flows which are produced from oil, and that I reallocate that to these low-carbon business, I'm contributing with my own, at my level, to this low-carbon future. Mm-hmm. So this is the way I look at it.
What about folks that say, for companies like Total that's created a venture fund, that's invested in companies like Saft, that's invested in other clean tech companies, that you can make investments in those companies, but how do you integrate them as a core part of your business? And what should the bar be for people that are trying to judge, or what's your bar for trying to judge those investments as a success?
There are two different things. We have a small venture fund, you know, it's for fun, okay, you know,
for fun.
$200 million, you know, no, it's good. In fact, you know, for me, that's a small, it's a fun story. I mean, it's a, you have, in a large corporation like Total, you have one of the difficulty, because we are successful, it's a form of arrogance, and how can you capture innovations which are small, which are far from the way we, our teams, could behave mainly on oil and gas. So the capital venture fund is more a way to go to some small matters, you know, and to identify innovations which could make sense. And it's also a way to oblige the people to listen and to keep their eyes open to what is happening around us. Mm-hmm. More fundamental, when we invest in Saft, we have acquired Saft. This is we spend $1.1 billion to acquire a battery company, Saft. So that's, it's a real business, you know. When we are a majority shareholder of SunPower, like we will acquire Direct Energy. Direct Energy is the first gas and power B2C company in France after EDF and Engie. So it was the first competitor and will become one of the large competitors. And when we acquire these companies, this one is for 2.5 billion euros, so it's quite big investments. Mm-hmm. It's because we consider that they will be part of this segment of activity that we want to develop, what we call the low carbon part, I mean, and gas and value chain. So these companies, we integrate them, and even if they have the knowledge, you know, you have, in a way, when you diversify, you need to acquire talents. I have no people in the company who knew anything in batteries before, you know, and even in electricity, you have to. We are electricity consumers, but we don't have really the talent. So, when we need at a certain point of time, if you are serious, if you want to develop in the business to acquire not only assets but people, which is people at the end who will develop the company. So all these acquisitions, for each of them, and they understand that challenge. is to become the core of the development of the Total Group within these businesses. So we integrate them, and we also try to respect them in a way that they know better than us their business. Mm-hmm. But you know, but Direct Energy obviously will become for us tomorrow the core of the development in the B2C business in Europe for Total, and we begin by France, Belgium. We see what will be the expansion after that. But we have the financial capacity to do that, to attract these talents. And I think one of the interesting matters is that we are considered as being serious. It's not greenwashing. I mean, when you put 1 billion in batteries, 2 billion on a B2C business, and the people are interested to join the group because they see this momentum in which we are, month after month or year after year, building this business.
Well, and it's an important signal for those industries and those sectors of the seriousness that you put on their ventures as well. Let's move to gas for a minute because you already brought it up. Very big gas player just purchased or agreement with Engie for their LNG business. Developing gas here in the United States, you've already talked a little bit about how across the gas value chain is the place to be competitive, but you're not the only company making big moves in the gas space. How do you be competitive developing the global gas market?
If we consider that, yes, the gas demand will grow, and in particular within that gas demand, the LNG market is growing very quickly. In the last 3-4 years, it was plus 7% as an average per year, and the future continues to grow. So LNG is the way to connect the markets. We had the opportunity, there was not many opportunities, in fact, to make an inorganic growth, becoming clearly number two in this market. Beyond the Shell is number one. Shell made two acquisitions, Repsol and BG. There was only one left company, which was Engie. So we managed to we will integrate it. So we have now a size of 40 million tons per year, which will be more or less 10% of the world market. In fact, it's important because there is an evolution in the gas market. You know, it was before it was a regional market with not so many connections, because gas has one difficulty. It's difficult to transport, you know, and there is a logistic cost. But we are clearly going because we have much more points of production in the US, in Australia, in the Middle East, everywhere. You have plenty of points of production of LNG and also many customers. You know, there was a technology evolution with the FSRU, the floating storage and regasification units, and for $200, $300 million, you can have a point of access to a market like in Bangladesh, in Pakistan, in Vietnam, in Myanmar. So we are creating a network of LNG producers and consumers. And so clearly, one of the main challenges there is how can you optimize of the cost of logistics? And in fact, it's back to what we've done in oil 30 years ago with oil trading, you know. Mm-hmm. So you have to be a much more fluid market. And we can drive the cost down, which is fundamental for the gas consumers at the end, to bring the gas price down and energy gas price down if we want to be competitive to coal. And so what the evolution for me is fundamental. Total was one of the largest LNG producers, but we are becoming tomorrow with Engie acquisition, LNG supplier, which means LNG portfolio manager, LNG trader. And the objective will be clearly to make at the end with LNG more affordable for the consumer. So yes, there are competitions, but it's a competition if you look at it. Well, it's big boys, you know. It's the big major oil and gas major companies, Shell, Total, Exxon, Chevron. So you don't see many small and medium-sized companies. Of course, you have some national companies like QP, etc. But it's a good game for oil and gas major. Yeah. It's a game between us with big national companies in front of us, you know, CNPC in China, CPC in Taiwan. So this is exactly the type of business environment that we are accustomed to. So, I mean, for me, it's an obvious case to try to develop the company, and this is really a strong axis of development.
What do you say to folks that say gas is good as far as it goes, but it's not really the level of clean fuel that we need, particularly considering methane challenges and things like that?
Yeah, that's a U.S. story, but... we have to take it seriously. Yeah. There is an argument. We need to measure it. I think that's the type of things which, for me, is a little... This is why I say I know that there are some NGOs which are strong about it, but when we look to the data as we have internally, and it's a subject that we take very seriously at the level of a club that we have created between 10 major companies, the Oil and Gas Climate Initiative, with some European companies and national companies. So we take that subject as the number one subject, in fact, as very seriously. And the first step is to have more data, to understand the point. Because when we look to the chain which we are responsible, which is a production, we have very minimum methane emission for Total. It's less than 0.2%. So we are very far from 2 to 3% that I can read in some papers. And in fact, but it doesn't mean that we are not responsible, because the more we look at it, the more we begin to understand that it's more a matter of city gas distribution networks. So if in the city of Boston you have a very old city gas network, you could have some leakage there. We are also, even if it's not our business, to look and to understand, because it's a question of global approach, and we cannot say we are not responsible of what is happening with the products that we provide, because we want this product to be developed. And we are all convinced, fundamentally, you know, when you produce power electricity with gas, the emission is twice less than when we coal. And I know that people advocate in particular here for clean coal, but frankly, clean coal means a lot of CCUS, and I would like to see where the CCUS is, technologies are. So, I mean, it's easier to with gas. By the way, you probably all know that if today, with a magic tool, we are able to switch in this world all the coal-fired power plant to gas-fired power plant, immediately we would be on the 2-degree scenario, immediately. So when people speak about big technologies and all that, it's not fully true. You know, a gas-fired power plant is not a high tech. It's just a matter of bringing the natural resource. It's a matter of convincing China and India and the U.S. to give up on the coal-fired power plant. I mean, which is complex, because what is complex behind is that in the energy world is mainly driven by the affordability of energy. Affordability or low cost energy is fundamental, and this is the real antagonism for me, fight between climate challenge to be able to get on the roadmap of 2 degrees, is that in fact what drives the world is having access to a low cost energy, to an affordable energy, because it's the primary element of any social economic development of any country. And so wherever I go around the world, when you go to Southeast Asia and in an emerging country, the real issue for the policymakers is to have access to the lowest cost energy possible. And today it's coal there. So they develop coal, you know, and so that's the real challenge of to convince the people. Again, it's back to of can we drive price of gas at a lower level. I mean, that's all what we need to do.
So you've mentioned a couple of times we're in the U.S. We had another prominent French individual, President Macron, here not too long ago, and he addressed the U.S. Congress. I want to talk to you a little bit about your perspective on the U.S. in relation to this challenge in particular. Just a quote, the president addressed the U.S. Congress and had some comments on climate change, which were some people think that securing global current industries and their jobs is more urgent than transforming our economies to meet the challenge of global change. I hear those concerns, but we must find a transition to a low-carbon economy. What is the meaning of our life, really, if we work and live destroying the planet while sacrificing the future of our children? And to be honest with you, I think that maybe there were a lot of folks for whom that comment resonated within the U.S. Congress, but there were also a lot of folks for whom that probably was a non-starter and not really where the U.S. addresses these issues. How important is it for you, particularly because you have a large and growing presence, a Washington office now as well, how important is the U.S. perspective on this challenge for your business?
This is obviously the U.S. is important, but again, I think whatever the decision of your policymaker is, in fact, the reality is that it's the country where we have seen the most positive evolution in the last 10 years. So it's strange to me, for a rational man, to see that in a country where, in fact, you have been a strong evolution in the right direction for the climate change, because you have one treasury, which is all the gas which have been discovered in this country. You are sitting here on a huge bubble of gas, Every day, the more you produce shale oil, you produce more shale gas, and gas and gas. I think it's the country which will benefit from a very long-term, low-cost gas resource and a low-price gas resource. And we have seen a shift from gas to from coal-fired power plants to gas-fired power plants. So whatever the policymakers, and as this country is driven first by economics, more than policy making.
Yeah.
The reality is that you have here and so I'm optimistic, whatever the position is of about towards the agreement, and I'm sure that one day the US will come back within the agreement if they ever exit, by the way. So I think that President Macron was right, and on that point he will maybe have a success. For us, I mean, I have no doubt about the interest to invest in the US. And mainly, by the way, as again, the gas value chain. Mm-hmm. And so this is why one of the important assets in the LNG acquisition is that we are becoming shareholder of the Louisiana Cameron LNG plant, and which will start end of 2019. Producing LNG in the US from these low-cost gas base is an obvious business case. I mean, I have no doubt. Mm-hmm. And it's why we need to be part of it. It's also a place where you can, you have a benefit from these low-cost gas costs. It's also a low energy price, and so when you think to developing downstream business, petrochemicals, mm-hmm. It's not very complex again. If I'd have to build a new cracker, I make it in the US, I will have access to low-cost ethane, low taxation, a stable country, I hope so. I'm not a chemical company. I mean, I have my petrochemical arms, but I will be a chemical company. I wouldn't put a lot of money in the U.S. So for us, it is really, and this is a reality. So, and you know, we have done last week or 2 weeks ago, we have announced that we have invested in a company called Clean Energy.
Yeah.
Clean Energy is a U.S. company which is developing natural gas for trucks network. It's very interesting, you know. And why did we make that investment? It's a company, a market cap was $3 billion 5 years ago. There was a big enthusiasm in the US about LNG trucks and CNG trucks and all that. Then when the price of oil collapsed, obviously the spread between oil, diesel, and natural gas narrowed, so the market cap collapsed to $300 million. So maybe today when I see, thanks to the US as well, when I see the oil price going up and up and up, maybe it was the right time to invest. And so there is there for me, it is one country where this natural gas for trucks could work, it's here. Because you, again, I believe you have for long this giant resource of low-cost gas in the U.S. So there are plenty of reasons, you know, again, and so why we are investing, by the way, in the last 3-4 years. We grew up our asset base from $6-7 billion to $10-12 billion soon. And so the U.S., whatever policymakers think, first, the reality of climate change is there. Yeah. Second, in fact, you are, because again, but you know, it's for me, I, when I began my career 30 years ago, I began in environmental matters. In fact, I was in charge of controlling the emissions of plants in the north of France. And what I'm considering, environment progress only because economic decisions are taken, mm-hmm. not because of regulations. Mm-hmm. It's not true. You can regulate, but you know, even when you regulate, at the end of the day, you have to convince the companies, the industries, to make the right investments, to go in the right direction. Mm-hmm. It's more a question, and they will do it or not to do it, even if you find them. That's not enough. At the end of the day, if you want the environmental, the air quality to progress, you need to convince them to make the investments. Mm-hmm. And so in the US, it's working, the economic dynamic is positive, mm-hmm. and will continue to be positive, you will see.
So you brought up the regulatory environment. I must ask you, I mean, this administration has really regarded its deregulatory efforts as one of the things it's doing that's positive for the industry in addition to tax reform. Are you seeing the regulatory and policy environment in a positive way here in the U.S., or is it really back to sort of the economic?
Honestly, I think compared to Europe, the regulation were much lower, I can tell you. So.
Yeah.
Deregulating something which is much lower is fine, but it's not fundamental, I would tell you, from my point of view. Now, the difficulty in the US for a European company is your legal system. In fact, what is not much lower at all is the level of fine. Mm. because we are facing a very strange mechanism system. And I think in Davos, we had a dinner with your president, and he wanted to meet 12 or 13 European leaders. And we told him, he told us, what is the risk of the US? And we answered that, your legal system. Because we can face incredible suits, legal suits, with all your lawyers and all that, which for European companies are very strange, you know. And we face sometimes, we are able to obliged to negotiate deals, which to us are much higher to what we should do in a normal world. So that's the difficulty. Yeah. But it's another way to approach the legal matters. So we'll need to, we are obliged to learn there.
Yeah.
But we learn every day.
Yeah.
And so honestly, I think one point which was which has probably an positive influence was after the Macondo accident, the regulations on the deep on the offshore regulation for exploring oil and gas in the Gulf of Mexico was clearly very very tough and very stringent, mm-hmm. and very costly. So I think that some moves which have been done recently are opening again. But it's probably because the regulation was an answer to a lot of legitimate emotion, you know.
Yeah.
So, of course, the policymakers have made things very stringent after the Macondo accident. And even on, in our companies, by the way, we have also enhanced the level of specifications. But we have been probably too far, so it was becoming too expensive.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, by the way, in the Gulf of Mexico, when you see the players today, it's more big players who are coming back. The companies who have capacity to face this type of risk, and I think it's a good move to have to be less stringent because we can. I'm convinced we will drill, and we have made a big, beautiful discovery with Chevron, the Ballymore discovery, beginning of the year. We can drill very safely without being obliged to over specify the well that we are drilling.
Mm-hmm. I want to touch on oil markets and geopolitics for a minute before we open it up to the audience for questions. You mentioned a couple of times already the last 3 years have been one in which companies have to find out a way to be resilient to a volatile and low oil price environment. We seem to be in a different step now, whether you call it a rebalanced market or just a period where prices are a bit higher. OPEC is starting to look at new targets, making new signals. Where do you think we are today as far as the oil
price? We are in a new world there. We are in the world of where the geopolitics are dominating the oil price again. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure we are rebalancing. It's not true. According to our internal calculation, the inventories are still 100 million barrel. The OECD inventories are still 100 million barrel above what they should be. What they should be is, in fact, the question because OPEC has made something strange. You know, they tried to correct it. By the way, it was to compare the OECD inventories to the five-year rolling average.
Mm-hmm.
Of course. As there was a growing supply, you had 5 year growing average is going up and up and up. In fact, the reality, if you take the level of inventories in 2010, 2012, were more or less around 58 days. The demand has increased in the meantime. So if you apply the same ratio, we are still above. We still have above in terms of inventory. So we are not fully rebalanced. It's not true. What is clear in the market, you have a strong dynamic for demand, plus 1.5 million barrels of oil per day, that's clear. The OPEC, non-OPEC with Russia, Saudi Arabia, Russia agreement has been implemented efficiently. They are very compliant, that's also true. But on the top of it, clearly, you have geopolitics and the announcement on Iran clearly is pushing the price up. And I would not be surprised to see $100 per barrel in the coming months. Because clearly, you will have some impact, and we all have. We know we are back to the situation where we were before the 2016 mm-hmm. agreement.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And in the meantime, Iran has grown its exportation by 1 million barrels of oil per day. So this 1 million barrels of oil per day is in question today.
Mm-hmm.
And on the top of it, you have Venezuela, which is really a catastrophic situation, and the production is declining. So you have many impact on the supply
mm-hmm.
for mainly geopolitical events, not linked to supply and demand, not linked to OPEC, which are impacting the supply in every way.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you have the dynamic of the US dynamic with Permian and Shell oil. But even here, you have strong investments, but you have a lack, you have some bottlenecks in pipeline for oil, pipeline for gas. And when I discuss with my peers in who are involved in the Permian, they all tell me that it will take 18 months before to solve. So we can face a situation there between today and end of 19 with not enough new oil coming into the market and a lot of disruption of the supply. And this is why you see the price going up and up and up. And we are at $80 Brent last week. We reached $80 Brent again. I think it could continue. Is it for long? I'm not convinced. So it's why, maybe because also I've experienced, you know, to become CEO of a company when the price collapsed to $27 per barrel, you know what it means to be a little prudent. So we continue to drive the company at $50. I continue to maintain the idea that there will be volatility, because once these bottlenecks will be solved, the U.S. machine will come back again, because if the price remains at $80, the investments in the industry will come back again, and so we will recreate the dynamic, which will create again supply back. And at $80 per barrel, there will be some impacts on the demand. I think a mistake which is done in the comments today, people consider that the demand is good for this year. It's true, but will continue next year. It's not true if we are at $80. I can observe, even in France, you know, I begin to see people complaining about the gasoline price, because in the last 3 years, the government, of course, as the price of oil was very low, has increased the taxes, which is good game, but no, today you have a high price and the high taxes, so you have people complaining. And France is not important, but in emerging countries, I begin to see that move of governments, and if you read the weak signals in newspapers, there are matters of subsidies again back in some emerging countries, which will damage the economic growth. And so I don't believe we will keep a strong demand of 1.5, 1.6 million barrels of oil per day, per year, at $80 per barrel. It's not true. Mm-hmm. By the way, look what was the increase of demand when we had this type of price 6-7 years ago. It was less than 1 million, around one. Mm-hmm. So that's why we are in a volatility, because you never manage to, and I know that our OPEC colleagues, they dream to have a stable price. I mean, it's just a dream, you know. But you know, 3 years ago I said, whenever I interviews, there is this theory of a price ceiling, there was a price floor, now there is a price ceiling, you know. Before it was never under 80, today it was never above 60, like 3 years. And I will tell you, all that is absolutely wrong. The reality is that the market, you have moves in these markets which could be much quicker than when you think. So the idea of stability is a dream for the ruler of producing countries, but will never happen. So we'll see what the OPEC will do. I would be them. I would tell you, I would not change my policy. Mm-hmm. I would stick to the policy. Mm-hmm. Because for them, obviously, it's much better to stick to the policy, to see the price at 80, mm-hmm. rather than to lose the discipline. But you know, if you have cycles, it's because fundamentally you lose the discipline, you forget. And one of the main challenge for me in my company will be to try to manage to maintain the discipline. But even for me, you know, of course, when I see files coming to me today, last year when we made the Maersk Oil acquisition, we acquired it at $50 per barrel. By the way, it was a good move, because today it's at 25. So it's much better than what we anticipated. We were not prescient. Huh? We didn't dream about it. So we were right to acquire the low cycle. But it's true that today when people came to my office, I'm looking to 50, I'm looking to 60. You know, it's a question of human psychology. You cannot. So the question of discipline, keeping the discipline is really, it's human. For me, the cycles are linked to this difficulty of maintaining to be permanent.
Yeah.
Of course, we'll try to do that. So that's point.
If oil price stability is the dream of OPEC, maybe capital discipline is the dream of IOCs.
Yeah.
Huh?
Yeah. But you know, yeah, it's a dream, because in fact, let's be clear, for us, we made huge efforts to have a break even going down to $30 pre-dividend and $50 post-dividend, having 75, okay, we are very comfortable. So one of the objectives will be to keep that break even at that level, because that means that then we can deliver more dividends or buy back shares to our customers, to our shareholders, but also we can grow, use part of these extra revenues to grow the company in the new energies, low carbon businesses. You know, so if I'm doing more today in this business, it's because part of the extra money we reallocated to this type of business. Mm.
I know everybody's going to want to ask you questions. The last thing I want to ask before we open it up is clearly there was a JCPOA announcement that's been the subject of much speculation here. You released an announcement on it yesterday about what it means for you and South Pars. What would you like to say about how that changes your perspective on investment in Iran, your investment in particular, but then also just the regional dynamics? You're so familiar in so many places in the region. Do you think it will have a broader effect as well?
Of course, it will have a broader effect, but I'm not in charge of not a politician, neither a diplomat. So, of course, it's not neutral at all. It has a major effect on the dynamic in the region, and we will see the effects step month after month. I mean, for us, to be clear, I've always been very clear. We have decided to look to that project in Iran because of the JCPOA, which means end of secondary sanctions. As soon as the U.S. decide to put back in place the secondary sanctions, there is no possibility for us to be a major company, a global company. You know, I took three examples, you know, press release yesterday and statement. Secondary sanctions means that the U.S. president can decide that Total cannot have access to any U.S. banks. I cannot run a company in 130 countries with any access to any U.S. banks. It's impossible. This is our world. 90% of the financing of Total are linked to U.S. banks. So it's not possible. The second possible secondary sanction is that it could give order to investors not to invest in Total. I have more than 30%, almost 35% of U.S. shareholders. I will not lose them. It's not possible. And then it could also give order that we could be have problems with our assets in the U.S. I have more than $10 billion. We intend to grow. So it's not possible. So it was always clear to us. We decided to sign South Pars because there was an international framework by the JCPOA. We've done it fully legally. It was an opportunity. We negotiated it. I think it is a project which is not growing the export revenues to Iran, domestic gas. We made even, as we stated, people probably discovered that we were very stringent with our teams. We told them we don't want one single revolutionary guards being any economic interest in any of the contractors we work, and we implemented strictly that policy. So we participated, I think. So let's be clear, it's not because we invest that we are naive and we don't see the global regional dynamic where we are very involved. So at the end of the day, I am in charge of protecting Total, you know, and it's our interest of the company. And the only way, if we want to make that project, it would be to have a project waiver from the U.S. Mm-hmm. Not sure it will be easy to obtain, to be honest. But we have also a contract with Iran, that we respect, which is asking us to ask the support of the French authorities to get that waiver. French authorities will discuss, and as we said, we are engaging to examine the possibility to get it. If I'm here in Washington, I will meet the people. But again, to be clear, today and every state, I gave instruction to make no further commitments to South Pars 11 because the global trend is that by November 4th, we'll have unwind all our operations in Iran. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the law and that's the rule of the game, and we are playing and we are working with the rule of the game in the best interest of the company of Total. So what will happen to the dynamic of the region will be another interesting position to observe. You know, we have a strong position in that region in Abu Dhabi, in Qatar, and in Saudi Arabia mainly. Mm-hmm. We are continuing to invest in these three countries, and my big hope is that it will not be will not see in that region a sort of an explosion. I mean, let's see, an armed conflict. Maybe we are not so far, but we'll see. That's not my job to try. We do our best to do that. Let me be clear, at the end, South Pass 11 for us was a nice opportunity, and we would have, but we have been quite prudent. We remind to everybody, because there were plenty of figures, what we spent only until now, $40 million. You know, we had adapted our calendar to understand what President Trump will do. Mm-hmm. And so that will be, so we will do our job. And engage with the French government and the US authorities, but at the end, my duty and the board of directors' duty is to protect the company, and we have many opportunities in that world, you know.
Okay, what we're going to do is I'll take questions from the audience, name and affiliation, question in the form of a question, wait for the microphone. I'll take three at a time, so I don't know if you want to grab a pen, but we'll start with David, and then, hold on, sorry, you all jumped up, and then Richard, and then this gentleman here, and then I'm going to take over here. David.
David Goldwyn, Goldwyn Global Strategies and the Atlantic Council. Thank you for your illuminating and candid comments today. My questions are about Venezuela. As you may know, the United States is considering banning the export of diluent and the import of hydrocarbons from Venezuela as a way of pressuring them to respect their legitimate constitution. And the prospect that they may steal the next election is kind of a forcing event. So two questions. One, for Total, what would be the impact of those sanctions if they were implemented on the sector? Would it just change flows, or would it actually achieve its purpose of forcing a decline in production? And the second is, how do you evaluate the ethical or reputational risks of operating a country like Venezuela if it steals an election like that and is considered by the international community as illegitimate?
Thanks, David. And then go to the one behind you, Richard. Thank you.
Richard Newell, Resources for the Future. Something totally different. Total is a French company, and France historically has been heavily invested in nuclear power in the electric power sector. As Total becomes increasingly involved in the electric power sector, do you have a view on the role of nuclear either in your company's portfolio or more generally within in the power sector?
Okay. And then this gentleman in the white shirt right there. Can you just put your hand up? There you go. Nice teamwork, guys.
Hello. Rob Pittman from Natural Resource Governance Institute. In recent years, there's been increasing momentum around the idea of disclosing contracts between governments and companies to increase accountability and trust. There are now 40 governments around the world that are doing this, and 18 companies have come out publicly in favor of the policy. Total has been a really strong mover in this space. It was the first supermajor to come out with a policy in favor of contract transparency, and it also goes further to say that it would also advocate for contract transparency in the countries in which it works. I'm just interested in how you're going to be rolling out this policy.
Okay, interesting questions. First, Venezuela. Yes, we are involved in Venezuela. For two assets, we are producing gas, domestic gas, and frankly, it's zero negative operations, so it's not very important. And then we are still producing heavy oil within a GV, which is operated by PDVSA, together with Statoil, in the Orinoco Belt. The production is declining because you have there a lack of everything, a lack of money, a lack of tools, a lack of maintenance become an issue. We have really some safety concerns. We make some audits recently in order to see, because we are running an upgrader, so we are decision to continue or not to run this upgrader is there. Having said that, there is also the political landscape. We have been obliged to put all our people out. There is no more expatriates in Venezuela. It was impossible to keep families, and even for, as it seems that they are the government that is willing to take some people and to put them into jail for funny acquisition. My first duty is to take care of my people wherever I am, not only the expatriates but also the Venezuelans. So we are trying to take care of all of them. And so that is clearly a big concern. The philosophy in Total is that, and it has been, is deeply rooted in our DNA. We stayed in Myanmar for decades, despite all the criticism and the reputation risk, because we consider that as long as we can conduct our operations according to a code of conduct, we must stay, even during difficult times. Because it's easy for us to say we leave because we don't like it. But again, if I don't like Myanmar by that time, I don't like Venezuela, tomorrow it will be Sudan. I'm not in Sudan, but oil and gas is where it is. And okay, I could maybe choose, but we are deeply thinking that it's also a matter of standing together with the people of a country where there are difficulties. Having said that, the limit of what I said is the international laws. If it's forbidden to stay, if it's impossible to stay according to a code of conduct, then we will have to leave. And so today's situation is clearly degraded. I will not make any political comment, but obviously we can also... It's a country which was 20 years ago a very beautiful country. I mean, PDVSA was one of the best companies in the world. For me, it's a pity. I mean, it's incredible to see off the degradation there for the people living there, for the economy, and we are observing the collapse of the country, in fact, in the 21st century. That's a matter of, it was a democracy, it's maybe not very much the case today, to be clear. We continue. At the end, let's be clear, for Total, it's not a very important in terms of capital employed, it's not very big, you know. But the philosophy, the DNA is that you have to stay as long as you can because people will remember. One day it will come back. I think Total will be there for longer than the political regime of Venezuela. So people like in Iran, they remember when the company stands together during difficult times, even the politicians, you know. So this is a way. So, and in this business, leaving a country is a very tough decision because it takes a lot of time to convince the people that we can come back, that we are loyal. It's a question of loyalty. It's a question of values, all that. So again, but if the values are no more, all values are no more respected, we will have to leave. Nuclear is clearly Total will not invest in nuclear. I've been very clear about it. It's capital intensive. It's nuclear. If I was in charge of an oil and nuclear company, I would do only nuclear, and not oil. Why? Because nuclear is plenty of security concerns, you know, securities, and for me it's difficult to be. It's a segment where I think the state have to be involved. And so I'm not willing to have the state in my among my shoulders. I prefer to be a nice company, privately run, I mean, no problem. But nuclear, I think for me, most seriously, there was before the Japanese accident.
Fukushima.
Fukushima and after Fukushima. Fukushima, for me, has changed the views that we have all on nuclear. Because you had a huge accident in one of the most developed countries, where we all think that Japanese and the capacity, technological level and capacity of control was strong. So that reveals that there are some, and this was a major accident. I mean, more than a major accident, it's a catastrophe. So from a CO2 point of view, from a climate change challenge, the nuclear share in the energy mix should grow. Because it's CO2-free. And the question of nuclear waste is a 1,000-year scale effect. Once, and at the same time, the CO2 challenge is a 100-year. So you could, rationally, you could do more nuclear. But I think you have this security issue, which is a major point. And I think it's difficult to promote civil nuclear while at the same time you don't want to have military nuclear, because all that is mixed somewhere. And so I'm... France is a very specific country. We have, we are always strange in France. You know, energy in France is an independent country. We have built this nuclear industry, which is EDF is a beautiful company running that very well. You have a consensus in France. The public opinion is not against. It's very strange, despite Fukushima, despite Chernobyl. So we have a strong belief between the French people and their nuclear industry. Even if we'll have to face some renewal, the cost of nuclear is increasing because safety standards are increasing. So all that makes a big debate, even in France, where we are willing to go to escape and to lower the nuclear share, to go more to renewables. I don't think there is a big future for nuclear. One country may be exception, which is China. But even in China, after Fukushima, the rhythm of building new nuclear plants has slowed down. Even there. And then transparency. I think it's, let me be clear. When I became CEO, I had a debate about fiscal transparency with my colleagues because we were criticized because we are not publishing the list of all the consolidated affiliates of the company and where they were established. And I took a strong position. I told them, in the 21st century, we have to be transparent. A company like Total, in fact, we are global companies. We are a form of economic power, $170 billion of market capitalization. And the society is looking to us as being more powerful than many countries, in fact. And so we cannot just say we are, because we are businesses, we are hidden in our... I'm not hidden at all in France, I can tell you. I discovered that we can become CEO. Each time I was saying something publicly, it was making some headlines. So it's not true. A company like us, we have to assume our responsibility vis-à-vis society. And the society is asking us more and more. They want to understand how you can make billions of dollars. And I think it's legitimate. We can, and this is important. It is for me something that we need to take into account, all the global companies. If you see populism growing in many countries, it's also a message to us. It's a message to us. And we cannot just say, we pay our taxes and we are rid of that. We have made our duty towards the society because we pay taxes. People are asking us, otherwise it is our business model which will be into question. You know, when people are, in many elections, are voting against for less protectionism, less open trade, etc., more protectionism, less open trade, it's against us somewhere. And so we need to be more proactive, and transparency is part of it. So I have published this whole list of subsidiaries, and yes, we had still 11 subsidiaries in even tax haven countries. So reality, 11 out of 1,000 is not much, you know, we have done big efforts. And so on the contract story, I think we have to encourage the governments. The limit is that I'm not ready to publish myself on my internal site all the contracts, because these contracts are with governments. I have to convince the governments proactively. And you know, there was a debate, for example, in Senegal. We have obtained last year a direct exploration contract with Senegal by a direct negotiation, which was perfectly clear. I went there to say, and there was a debate, and we have convinced the Senegal government to publish it. And it's public. There is nothing secret. But this is, as we are working with sovereign rights, you know, they are awarding the license. They have to do it. I will not do it myself. And recently there was, I think, a report about transparency. Oxfam has published one. We were among the top five. So my board was very proud of it. And but I will not, there were five categories. Leaders, only two companies. The leaders are the ones who publish themselves. No, I will not publish myself. I will remain sub-leader, but I will continue to be a leader towards the government. I think it's part, and it is the interest of the governments as well, you know, because, but the limit of transparency is what we are doing today with, because there is a European regulation, which is not in place, by the way, in the US, which is a distortion of competitiveness or controls. We are publishing a table with all the money that we are giving to governments around the world. Frankly, this table is absolutely not understandable. You know, we have big things, we have tables, we have plenty of things, it's very complex to establish. And last year we had a debate about Angola, which was an absolutely wrong debate, but people want to reconcile what is the taxation paid by a company, which is a complex system, with what they can see in the state budget. It's absolutely not possible. So I think there is a dream there that the more you publish, but I have no problem to publish that figures. The issue is that then we face questions which were wrong, and we have always the beginning of a sort of, dispute, which was absolutely no ground. No, it was wrong. So we had to explain again. But again, let's consider it is part of what we need to do to be acceptable to with the society. So,
great. Okay, we'll do another round. Get your hands. Let me get you in order. Okay, we're going to go here. The gentleman all the way in the back. And the person next to them. So I promised this side of the room.
Hello. Peter Sumler with Capital Intelligence, Middle East, North Africa. My question is more of an old question. National players in Europe seem to be like passe or anachronism. Your footprint's very similar to ENI Group of Italy. You're both sort of state influence. Is this the time that you'll be merging with ENI and Total? I mean, it would make sense on risk diversification, bring it back and be a more like free market player in the oil business. Thank you, sir.
Be fun to announce in Washington. Here you go. And then go to those in the back. Okay, great.
Yes, hi, Gugaraz with Argus Media. The phrase we heard from Brussels on was practical guarantees for Iran to continue be able to sell its oil and you know products. What kind of practical guarantees would Total take to offset what you described, the effect of secondary U.S. sanctions?
Great. And the person next to you, please.
Hi, Anar Virji with Al Jazeera English. I just wanted to clear something up on the issue of applying for a waiver. Today, President Macron said that Europe will try to protect its companies during business with Iran, but companies like Total can make their own choices. So just to clear things up, is the French government supporting Total and asking for a waiver? I know you mentioned that Total has asked the French government for support.
Those three?
Merging Total and I, you don't think I will answer? And I will answer. I already answered. I told you that I don't want the state to be among any state to be among the shoulder of Total. Then, next question. Practical guarantees, I answer. Again, we will engage with the French, and we are engaging with French and European governments to understand what they can propose. But fundamentally, we need a U.S. waiver because this is the only way to protect us from a unilateral decision from the U.S. to apply sanctions to Total. So maybe the diplomacy between Europe and U.S. will find a solution and we will look at it. But at the end, we'll have to take our decisions in the interest of our company and to protect the company. And there was a precedent in 1996, 1997, when we made the first South Pass project. We had such a waiver. It was a precedent. It was a result of a diplomatic discussion between Europe and the U.S. Mm-hmm. Are we in a situation today where we could have it? Again, I will consult with many U.S. officials and French officials. So, yes, we will engage. I cannot tell you, again, because it's also a matter of royalty vis-à-vis Iran. We have a contract, we have to respect the contract, we have some a way forward, maybe to opt out at the end. And this is, again, I told you that if there is no clear answer before November 4th, we will have unwind our operations. But I think it's probably a big test for the European, US-Europe relationships. But again, it's beyond Total, all that. Total is a corporation. We are a commercial company, you know. And we have one case. We have also other objectives in the company. And so we cannot mix the... I'm not a government. I'm not. It's not my job. It's not our objective, you know. And we have to continue to develop our group in the best possible way. And if we can do it, we'll do it. But I mentioned the reason why the U.S. are important to Total, and that's the case. Mm-hmm. So Europe has a challenge. The world has a challenge, in fact. What would be not good, neither for the U.S. nor for Europe, last comment on that, is that at the end, if only Russia and China can make business with Iran, I'm not sure it's very good for what we represent in the world, Europe and the U.S. And this will be the reality. So if you think from a higher point of view and the global interest of the world, the way that I think the allies of the Atlantic allies should think to that, do we want to give to all this Middle East region to China and Russia? This is what we are doing, step after step. That's a more global comment.
Okay, we'll do one last round. I have a Twitter question, though, so I'm going to get that one in, which is, companies struggle with effective communication, yet Patrick has personally developed a strong Twitter platform, clearly highlighting where Total is going. How are you the only CEO brave enough to do this? So that's one. And let's see, we'll do one right here, and then this lady right here. Sorry, Herman. Right here.
Warren Wilczewski, Energy Information Administration. Total seems to be following a pattern that has been established by one of your peers, Exxon, which is going downstream past the refining sector. You are making a major investment in the United States. in a joint venture with Novachem and Borealis. You've also announced last month a joint venture with Saudi Aramco, and then just this week, another one with Sonatrach in Algeria. So while you mentioned that the petrochemicals are a minor component of your business, it seems like this is where a lot of your money is going right now. Would you mind commenting as to what kind of a trend you're seeing in the energy sector vis-a-vis the petrochemical industry?
Yeah.
And then we'll do one final one right here.
Ivana Jemelková, FTI Consulting. Mr. Pujane, you have taken a leading role on an initiative known as the Hydrogen Council, which was launched at the World Economic Forum in Davos last year, bringing together CEOs of energy, transport, industry companies to essentially create a vision for hydrogen in the energy future. So going back sort of a full circle to where you started with your vision for Total's transformation and your vision for the role of gas in that transformation. Where does hydrogen fit in, and concepts such as renewable hydrogen, power to gas, and so on? Thank you.
Three things. I'm not sure I'm the only one. It's a challenge from my communication department. But I can tell you all the tweets are emitted by myself. We have no delegation at all. I refuse to do that because it's my, when something is emitted, it's my name. I signed it. And so even if sometimes they help me to prepare to send me the photo, I become an expert. I can make, copy paste and blah, blah, blah. But I can do that. Maybe because I'm younger than some of my peers. Even I think, I'll be clear. I think you have a new generation. It's a question of generation, of CEO generation. You know, I'm the first CEO in Total, which is using emails and all these tools immediately, which creates some problems because you have direct access. And by the way, my direct report needs to reinvent the way they interact with me because there is not a question. You have access. So you run the company in different ways. And tweeting is, for me, also what I answered today, communicating with people. I think we need to also to... So sometimes it's just saying where we are, what we do, but it's a way to... We have a society which evolves, and we need to be part of it. We cannot be out of it. Okay, it's only a small exercise. But by the way, people, even in the company, they follow me for the tweetings, the tweets. So, I mean, they know where I am, and we go around the world. It's also a question of motivation, and people are proud. And so we can understand. It's a way that the world is working, So it's not because we are one of the major companies in what is considered as an old industry. We are not an old industry at all. We are a very modern and very useful industry, and participating to these debates, even if it's only in the energy fields that I intervene, where I am competent, I think it's part of being an actor of the society. We are in the society. Mm-hmm. Second, but I'm proud to be one of the leaders, petrochemical. No, don't misunderstand. We invest more or less $3 billion per year to downstream businesses. I was in charge of refining and petrochemicals. So the strategy is to invest on large integrated platforms. In that way, I copy Exxon. When I joined this business, it was in 2011 because I was only in upstream before. I had a very interesting meeting dinner with the Exxon president of downstream. He told me, there is only one way to do it, is to invest permanently on the same platform during years and years and years and years and years, and to capitalize bolt-on investment. So we have 5-6 big platforms in the world. One is in the US, in Port Arthur. So there is logic. You will see us continuing to invest around this platform. And refining is more complex to me to understand exactly. Investing in refining is a little dangerous because to have a competitive advantage in refining is not so obvious. We had one in Saudi Arabia because there we were able to build a giant refinery together with Saudi Aramco, having access to a very low cost of energy and heavy fuel. So we had two advantages. Petrochemicals, it's easier because the polymer business, the petrochemicals, you have 55-60% of the world plastic, petrochemicals, which is based on naphtha. So as soon as you can have access to a advantage feedstock, ethane in the US, ethane in the Middle East, you are sure that your petrochemical plant will be competitive compared to the naphtha crackers. So for me, the game, you will not see Total investing in any naphtha crackers, or that means that I'm becoming to have a problem. You will see Total investing in petrochemicals where we have an advantage of the feedstock. And this is the case in all the countries, the projects you mentioned, either in the US because of the gas price, or in Saudi Arabia, or even in Algeria. By the way, we are not so small, and we are number 10 in petrochemical in the world, you know, so we are not such a small company. But when I think it's small, it's that, in fact, it's a business where you can't develop, add another $100 million, another $100 million of results, but a petrochemical project will not suddenly give you $1 billion of additional profits. You know, it's a lot of step-by-step approach. But again, there is a demand for polymers. We have to be careful, however, and I'm sure that we'll see a collapse in polymer price soon because you have too many projects. But there is one thing that people forget is the recycling of plastics. And recycling of plastics, it's really a request of the society. You have more and more regulations in Europe, like always, we are going too far, 50%, which is absolutely not achievable, but okay. Let's do more and more and more. But this will become reality, and this will impact the necessity for new crackers. So you have somewhere, people consider that the future of oil is only petrochemicals. No, I mean, yes, but there is a limit, like always, you know, you cannot just consider that. So this recycling phenomenon, you need to take that into account, and there is a limit. So for us, it's petrochemicals, but only on feedstock, which have an advantage. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, let's others investing. You have some people who have a different view, which is good, you know. I don't say I'm right. Hydrogen. No, I'm not a leader of hydrogen, you know, I can be. The real leader of the Hydrogen Council is Air Liquide. You know, Benoît Potier is much more competent than I am. We are friends, so why are we embarked in that? I have a strong belief that a company like Total, we need to understand all these energies. All that is interconnected. You know, I cannot just decide I invest in natural gas for trucks without understanding the dynamic of hydrogen for dedicated truck fleets. Because it's a question of competition between all these energies. Our views is that today, hydrogen is still more expensive than natural gas. And there is a big, so it can work, for example, you can imagine in cities where you will have, because of air quality in cities, that you will have a sort of big hydrogen station at the entry of a city where the trucks will rotate, but it's quite a heavy infrastructure. You cannot dream about having a hydrogen pump at each station. It doesn't work. But you have also a question of source of hydrogen. And unfortunately, people are dreaming, I know, about power to gas, but you know, making hydrogen with electrolysis is a very high cost technology. That's why in refining, we are making a lot of hydrogen, but taking methane to make hydrogen, which creates CO2. So you have there a problem of where the hydrogen is coming from, and a global CO2, calculation about the best way to do it. We have decided with ENGIE to invest, to make in particular in one of our biorefineries that we're investing in France. We have a contract elapsing by 2022, so we want to make it in an industrial scale because it's good to understand the challenge. But when you really invest, you see the figures, you understand what are the challenges, and then you open your mind. So I think, but my view on it is that it's more a longer term, natural gas, but maybe in 20 years. So we need to invest, even if the question after that is how much do I invest and what are my priority in terms of level of capital allocation? Mm-hmm. You, when you think about initiative, there's another initiative. I did not mention at all in my speech, as I'm in the US, I want to speak about it, which is a carbon price leadership initiative coalition. I think carbon pricing is really fundamental. I should have said that during my I'm sorry for my state.
That's okay.
Without any carbon pricing, there is no way to reach a world of 2 degrees. Because this is the only this is the economic element which will drive the choice of the economic investors. We don't need to have $100. This is too high. We make a mistake. We afraid everybody by saying that, and nobody wants to do that. You know, the UK experience has been superb. In UK, they have just put £20 per ton, or £18 per ton. And in 2 years, we have seen the electrical system of the UK shifting from coal to gas. So it's not... And we joined, there was an initiative by some of you old US treasurers, wise men, and we joined it last year to call for $30 or $40 per ton in a system where, in fact, it will not impact the consumers because you will recirculate the proceeds. I think it's a brilliant idea, and I hope that we will be able to put that in place. We cannot advocate for a world price. This is nonsense. Obviously, the world economies cannot accept the same level in India than in Europe or in the US. So let's stop that idea that we need to have the same. But let's try to make step-by-step approach on it, because it will help the transition that we were discussing.
Absolutely.
And to make the right choice according with this element.
Absolutely.
Thank you,
Patrick,
for your attention.
It is always so great to have you here. I hope your opening of the Washington office means you'll be back more often. You are always welcome at CSIS. Thank you for sharing your thoughts. Please join me in thanking Patrick.
Thank you.